Seeing you after a long time. You know, there was a sage in Mumbai who I think passed away in the 80s, and his sadhana was Aghori Tantra. It was quite radical and not everyone's cup of tea. Towards the end of his life, his name was Vimlananda. The given name was Vimlananda. We don't know his real name. He was in Mumbai. He passed away in the early 80s. So towards the end of his life, he told his main disciple, who was a Westerner, that if I was to sum up everything in one sentence, it would be, you must learn to live with reality, otherwise reality will come to live with you. You must learn to live with reality, otherwise reality will come to live with you. This was a man who was into a lot of practices. He could have a lot of siddhis, lot of the left hand of God path, it was called, supernatural events, clairvoyance, clairaudience. But at the end of it all, he said this one sentence. And if we dive deeper into what was he trying to say, we have to look at our own experience. We don't have to look at a textbook. We have to look at our daily living experience, which is, in life, everything is transient. Everything comes and goes. Pleasures come and go, pains come and go. Some pains stay, some physical pains stay. The day turns into night, that changes. Everything on our screen of daily living is nothing but transient. And it all disappears in deep sleep. Your waking state and the activities you are engaged in vanish in deep sleep. So, is something which comes and goes real? Is something which is so fickle that changes moment to moment, your thoughts, your views on certain situations, your views on people, your relationships, keeps changing. And not only does everything in life keep changing, but the foundation of life, which is our very existence from birth to death, is also transient. Is that real then? Because what is real must be there eternally. But the whole structure is set up for impermanence, in which we try to find security, in which we try to establish control. As Maharaj would say, what were you 100 years before you were born? What will you be 100 years after you pass away? And then that there's that small awareness which pops in between birth and death, and we think that that is me and my story. So the whole bedrock of existence is moving like a shadow, but we are so enmeshed and mired in this that we do not realize that this is all just images on the screen of life. So what does it mean when he says that if you do not learn to live with reality, realize that pleasures come and go, realize pain comes and goes, suffering comes and goes, everything comes and goes. And then with that realization, what happens? You are no longer buffeted by the winds of change, because you know this is the nature of life and living. You are no longer seeking only pleasure, because you know now with your personal experience that that is short-lived. As Maharaj would say, pleasure is the interval between two pains. So that is the nature of life. But what some of us do, which is also natural, is we try to stack up our pleasures. Only good things must happen. Nothing must go wrong in my life. I must avoid suffering to the best possible extent and only see that I'm happy. But that happiness is attached to an external situation, and that will never provide true happiness. That realization comes with one's own experience, because at some point we get tired of it. That is when the seeking begins. That happiness is not to be found externally through events, situations, or people, because that is not lasting. That is not true. So where is true happiness to be found if it is not to be found in the flow of life? It is to be found in one's attitude to life. And the one of the biggest causes of unhappiness is this need to want to control each and every situation, people in our lives, our own emotions, to control that we must not feel this way, we must feel that way. The individual has come and sat upon something and has started exercising this will and control of how things should be. They should be this way, they should not be that way. If I am seeing a river flowing, I must navigate the flow of the water so it moves, it avoids that boulder there and then it turns around, then I will be happy. I must control the way my parents relate to me, the way I relate to my children, with strangers on the street, colleagues at work. That control is what needs to be looked into. Life is natural. We will all be coming with our scripts and they include all the facets of life. But we create additional suffering when we say that no, according to us, things should not be this way. And the sages have said we human beings have been given a gift because we are the only species which can separate being from experience. An animal cannot do that. We are the only species who can separate our being from our experience because we are aware. We are aware that we are aware. I am aware that I am suffering. I am aware that I am enjoying. The animal does not have that degree of awareness. So, with the flow of life, you realize whatever tragedies you have faced, whatever high points you have seen, there's always that background of awareness which knows that this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. And what Maharaj would say is, with that understanding, you start abiding in your beingness, in that awareness. You start viewing things, situations, people, with that sense of being in which life presents itself. And it is a natural process. It is a natural happening. The ego needn't want to try to be aware, because to be aware is the absence of the me which wants to be aware. You see it. You have witnessed everything that has happened since birth. Who was there throughout? That is the dawn of witnessing. That is when the prism shifts and the next happening in your life is viewed with a sense of witnessing. And once again, Maharaj has said, only as a witness can you truly help another. Only as a witness can you truly help another. Which is what? Your sense of being, your presence. Your presence which is not mired in a story, which is not wrapped up doing cartwheels in the mind. That if this person says this, I must reply this. Reaction, 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 reaction. Because that is operating at the level of the mind. The dawn of witnessing is such a natural phenomenon because you will realize that setbacks don't affect you like they used to. You don't get swayed by pleasures like they used to. That is one's natural course of evolution when one looks back at one's life experiences. Relationships don't hurt you like they used to because the knowing is already there. This too shall pass because you've seen enough. And that starts becoming your stable ground of seeing. It is the rock of understanding that this peace, this equanimity was always there from time immemorial. It never left me and it is there now. And then you stop going out externally to clutch and control. The game starts changing. The wedge between being and experiencing has already been put into place because it's your experience itself. And what did you choose? You cannot choose the minute you fall asleep. Is that a choice that, okay, now, 3 minutes from now, I'm going to fall into deep sleep? does it happen that way? You don't know. You're gone. You hit the bed and you're gone. Deep sleep is not your choice. If you don't put the alarm, you will wake up when you are meant to wake up. That means we are quite comfortable knowing that one third of our life we have no control in deep sleep. But the balance two third, we are convincing ourselves that we are in control. So what happens when one does not learn to live with reality? Then reality will come to live with you. It is not being pessimistic or being hard on us, that statement. He's just trying to say that life will keep teaching us, keep showing us, keep mirroring us these situations till the understanding dawns that we are finding permanence in something which is temporary. And then one starts taking one's seat, one's true seat in consciousness as consciousness in action. What is? Being in the what is and not what should be is the reality. The conscious presence, not I am present, not I am being present, but the presence which is here right now, the presence which will be there when your next pain point comes up, the presence which will be there when your next pleasure comes up, the presence which is there when you laugh, which is there when you cry, and you start reclaiming your true position. And then the grip of the samsara, the grip starts fragmenting, it starts breaking up. No blame, no condemnation, no hatred, no malice, no jealousy, no envy, no guilt, no shame. Why? Because everything is the play of the same consciousness. Nobody truly does anything. Can you imagine in the kitchen the toaster blaming the juicer for producing juice? They are instruments in the kitchen. They are all powered by electricity. Without electricity, they would all be dead instruments. We are all powered by consciousness. We have all been designed and programmed by the divine to react and respond the way we have been conditioned to by our parents, by our society, by our genetics, by our environment, based on which we take certain decisions. All of us are all divine instruments through whom the same consciousness functions. When one lives with that understanding, who is there to blame? Who is there to condemn? Who is there to hate? Now, the Ashtapasha, which they say the eight snares of existence, so many of these drop away because when this understanding is there that nobody truly does anything, not my will, O Lord, but yours, be done. Life changes. The constriction of life is no longer there. You wish well upon people and your natural stance is one of compassion. It is not something to be developed because it is an automatic result of this kind of seeing. What happens? One stops criticizing others. One starts judging others. One stops complaining as much as one used to. Because the divine has manifested in this way. Where's the complaint? So the dialogue which used to take place, that those wheels start slowing down. And the beautiful, peaceful light of presence is given space to shine, which was always there, which was covered by the clouds of darkness. The bright, light, beautiful sky of beingness, not becoming and not been. That is a life well lived.
People may call you cowards.
People may say whatever they want, but the point is, who is at peace? And who is calling whom a coward? And does it really matter? When Ramana Maharshi's ashram was attacked in the middle of the night, he told his staff, let them take what they want. So people told him this. Is it that being cowardly, shouldn't we react? He said, no, they are doing what they are designed to do. We are doing what we are designed to do. Let them take it. When Jesus said, the meek shall inherit the earth, what does that mean? It is those who are truly humble and whom the sense of doership has been annihilated who shall inherit the earth. It is not an actual physical inheritance, what he was trying to point to. The point being that we are talking about peace in daily living. And it is worth investigating whatever aspect one needs to find that peace which is already there. And the entire Bhagavad Gita is on this. Do what you are designed to do. If Arjuna is designed to be a warrior, he is going to fight. He is not saying, no, peace, I am going to sit and not do nothing, which he started by saying. He started by saying that I cannot fight against my those who have taught me. Relatives and all I can fight, but my preceptors I cannot fight against. And he puts his bow and arrow down. And Lord Krishna says, but you were designed to fight. You have to pick up that bow and fight. But the results are not in your control. The results are not in anyone's control. That is what life has shown all of us. Yet we want to control the outcome. Amazing. And then we question why. Why did this not happen? Why did this happen? These why questions start dropping away. It's a big relief when why questions start dropping away. And as my teacher would say so often in the talks, people say, why did God create handicapped children? What harm have they done and to whom? And he said, nobody says, why did God create healthy children? Why is that? That is the basic duality of life. Healthy children and handicapped children. Rich and poor. Black and white. Up and down. Back and front. That's the structure of duality.
For us to understand things.
We are in duality. Manifestation is duality. But what we do is we convert that duality into dualism. Because the me and the other, which is the basic duality of life, has become me versus the other. The basic is me and the other. We are separate instruments, you and me. But we changed it through the sense of doership to you versus me, you as separate from me. How dare you say that to me? Who do you think you are?
But that's what I'm saying, like there is no high or low, it's just one. It just we see it differently because we want to see it differently.
Yes. And that is also not our doing. That is the way it is.
But I feel that there is no difference. It's we are creating this difference of rich, poor, black, white. There is no difference.
There are people who are poor and there are people who are rich. There is a difference.
It's like we have created that difference, right?
No, there are people with less money in their pockets and those with more money in their pockets. There is. Can't you see it?
It's in all of us.
Absolutely. But that one consciousness has manifested differently in different beings.
It has expressed itself differently.
Yes.
But that expression is not the reality. Expression is just an expression.
Everything is a part of the reality.
A real reality.
But what needs to be looked at is, the only thing is, as Arjuna felt, that I am the one who is going to kill them all. Who is that I? That is the Maya. That is the divine hypnosis. The me with its sense of doership. When the Lord says, dear Arjuna, I as time have already killed them. People truly don't choose. We think they choose to be who they are, how they are. Ramesh used to say that a miser does not choose to be a miser. A generous person does not choose to be a generous person. They are made that way. Where is the question of judging someone for being a miser? And this kind of seeing is in Advaita what is referred to as love. It is not a dualistic love of one object loving another object. This is the love of being in which everything is accepted. This is the love. People are accepted for who they are. This is a love which does not depend on anything for the love to happen. And people find this teaching cold. People find the whole perspective of Advaita cold when the whole foundation of Advaita, the whole foundation of teachings of Maharaj, of Ramesh, and these teachers is based on love. I mean, forget individuals. I am saying that you see the entire manifestation as instruments of the divine. Is that not love?
But you are living in a society which has certain laws and rules. Accordingly, it has been made that this act is good, this act is bad, whatever. Like now we can say this Ram Rahim episode. He is designed to do what he did. But according to the law of the land,
yes,
he is designed to go to the jail.
Absolutely. Because what about the consequences of your actions? He has to bear the consequences of his actions as per the legal provisions, which is exactly what is happening.
We say that we should not judge anybody. But automatically that judgment comes into us because of the law of the land. But in reality, going about, that judgment is also not correct.
Yes, because that only a seeker who's on the path will start investigating his judgments, whether they are based on the law of the land or on his own likes and dislikes. That is the journey of seeking. Why do all masters say do not criticize others? Because Maharaj says everything is the affair of the Brahman. To criticize something is to criticize Brahman, right? Because you're part of it. You're part of what is. You may not like something, and by all means take the necessary steps and action to do precisely what you feel you should do. But that dialogue which used to take place earlier of criticism, of malice, of hatred, that has vanished. You might not like a certain person who may be very close to you for being who they are, but that finger pointing has gone. You may still have preferences, because we all have preferences, but that thing of this person should not be that way, he must change or she must change, is gone. Wherever you find you are gravitating towards a set of friends, a set of relatives whom you are more comfortable with, be happy with that. It's a natural process. But there is no animosity anymore. There is no negativity. And that is called being in the now.
I have a question. It's a three-parter. Many teachers talk about surrender. They use this word surrender. So the question which comes in three parts is, what is surrender? What does it mean to be surrendered? And does humility arise spontaneously or naturally from the state of surrender?
According to me, there is no such thing as surrender, because what can we truly surrender is only what is ours. What is ours? When they say you must surrender, what are they pointing at? What to surrender? There's nothing which is mine. So the only thing to surrender is the sense of doership. That is the true surrender. And what we try to do is we try to surrender. I must surrender to this. When the true surrender is the absence of the you which wants to surrender. But we've taken ownership of the surrender itself. No, if I surrender myself to this circumstance, I'll be fine. Do you have a choice? The circumstance has already chosen you. So true surrender is truly, and this is not a play of words, true surrender is the absence of the me which wants to surrender. Then you are no longer in this mode of I must accept this, I must accept this. No, no, I must not think like that, I must accept this. That dialogue is gone because the acceptance is already there. Things are happening. You've accepted it already. You have already surrendered to the moment without the me sitting on top of that surrender saying that I am going to surrender. That is why, as Ramesh would say, that you cannot choose to be humble. Because to choose to be humble is to move a step away from being humble. To choose to be humble means the me wants to be humble. And true humility is not recognized by the one who has it. So this whole notion of I want to surrender is a setup. It's a trap. Because deep down, there is no you to surrender. Let things happen. surrender to the source. What is that? Thy will be done. Malik, jo aapki marzi, is surrender, which is surrendering your sense of doership.
Accepting is surrender.
It is. You know, Vimlananda, who was so advanced in sadhana, as I said, not the path of Advaita, but the path of Tantra Siddhi and all, he lost his son and he couldn't bear it. But he said, Divine Mother, this is your wish. I'm a broken man. But what could I do? There was no doership that because I have done these practices, because of this, because of that, this should not have happened to me. The situation arises, and what choice do you have but to accept it, to set up resistance to what is creating so much more suffering? As Ramesh would say, we are converting simple imprisonment into rigorous imprisonment. As it is, we are imprisoned in this body and in this lifetime. From birth to death is an imprisonment. We are imprisoned. Maharaj would say, you have squeezed yourself into the volume of a body and a span of a lifetime. And in that, we are converting what is simple imprisonment into rigorous imprisonment. Because this should not be this way, this should be that way. Why not keep it simple as our own realization that when we are in sleep in the night, we have no worries and problems. Why? Because the sense of me with its doership is not there in deep sleep. And that is why Maharaj would say the closest you can come as an example is the example of deep sleep. Because one knows that to wake up and say I slept well is the biggest fraud, because you did not exist in deep sleep to know you slept well. But yet there was something which was common between the deep sleep, dreaming and waking states. Otherwise you would not be able to say I slept well. That is the reality. That is the gift given to us. That in spite of ourselves, peace is not going anywhere. We just have to look inwards. And that is when the simple things in life which will give you such joy, such simple things in your own lives, you will feel that, you know, I don't need a pleasure to make me feel good anymore. I just want the simple things in life. Or if something goes wrong, you might end up laughing. Something which would have driven you up the wall earlier does not produce that anymore. And even if it does, the understanding is that even this was meant to happen, and you'll still end up laughing. Therefore, peace is your birthright. It is, and you know it. It's a fleeting moment. What is life? A few years? Fleeting. So living with the understanding creates witnessing, and you will see that life with all its aches and pains and ups and downs keeps going. But there's that deep sense of being which is untouched, uncontaminated by the me and my story, which is never leaving you. It is always there. We just need to invert our gaze, to look within, to see that gift. And then what was earlier a position of observing in the waking state becomes more and more of witnessing. Observing is me observing you and therefore judging you as good or bad. But now the gaze turns into witnessing. That is the gift of witnessing, which takes you through the journey of life.
Do I need to take any effort, or this will happen automatically?
It is automatic. You just have to look at your own life. Look at, in the evening, spend 15 minutes and see the events of the day. That's all. And you will come to this conclusion yourself. Like my teacher would say, you know, look at the events of the day and you will realize that you either saw something, smelled something, tasted something, touched something or heard something in the course of the day on the basis of which you took an action. Now, did you have any control over all those? Then how can you call it my action? But we call it my action. You had no control on all the factors which made you take a decision, yet you call it your decision. You had to be at a certain place at a certain time to see something. Did you choose that? And on the basis of that, you took a decision. That is to see the life in its entirety and oneness, as you were saying. To see that it is all interconnected. Not that there is no difference between rich and poor, that is a conceptual understanding. But to see the glory of how the universe structures each moment in your life to be precisely the way it is true humility. That is true humility. If you're having a bad day at work, the universe has conspired to give you that bad day at work. It's a relief because you know you didn't do it. You know you didn't do it. As I think Satya Sai Baba had said, you know, he said, now women are more prone to this because, you know, depending on the cycles of the moon, the moods change, etc. But we feel it's all in our control. Our emotions should not be this way. But there are so many planetary energetic influences over which you have no control. So who says it is your emotion? Who decided the chemical composition of the fluids in your body? Who has decided what would have transpired? You were crossing the road and you saw something which really upset you. Did you plan that? Can you see the number of factors which are contributing to each and every moment you are living and breathing in on this planet? It is a divine conspiracy. It is absolutely fantastic.
Experience at some point a loss in our life. It could be a loss of a person or a situation or a piece of property. What is the best attitude or approach with regards to experiencing loss or even the possibility of loss? Because even that can sometimes bring us discomfort as human beings, you know? Not even the loss of it itself, but even the thought that we may lose, you know? So what is the best attitude or approach when experiencing these things?
That's a very beautiful question you asked, Vatsal, because that has been my journey and it is everyone's journey. It is a journey of loss, to lose, to find who you truly are. You see, my journey, I think, unconsciously began when I lost my father at the age of 14. That was my first experience of a physical loss. And I had a very deep level of awareness with death. Because from a young age, to be exposed to death gave a heightened sense of being watchful about what is death, and death of strangers, of people close to me, of family, my colleagues at work, their members. I had this heightened antenna which was going up. It could be the fear related to death, but to know about death. And with every loss, it felt like a part of me was dying. So the investigation for me began very early into what is this loss. And this loss is not just people. It becomes the loss of everything in life. A valuable object you lost, you treasured something and it broke or someone stole it, loss. You had a cherished relationship and your friend fought with you, loss. Life was teaching me about loss every time. Then what happened? I realized that when it is me and mine, my dog when he died, my dog, not a stray dog on the street which died, who used to sit in the passage and welcome me every morning for 17 years, and one day he was gone. And I felt a vacuum. When I came home, I felt his absence. The form which used to be there had vanished. Now that vacuum looks like an external vacuum, but that vacuum is felt inside. And I realized, and I posed this question to Eckhart when I had met him, but to come to that a bit later, I realized that whatever one loses points to emptiness. Whatever is lost is felt inside as a loss. And why is it felt as a loss? Because there's nothing there. Loss. If everything was stripped away from you, you'd be empty. So, this investigation kept going. The day before I was to meet Eckhart in Chennai to take him to Thiruvannamalai, my grandmother passed away. She was ailing. We knew she was going. But I was at a dilemma that should I cancel my trip because she was in the ICU, or should I go ahead because we had helped organize a lot of things. I was taking him and his group to Thiruvannamalai. And she passed away the night before, and the funeral was in the morning, and then I caught the plane to the airport. What did I feel? Loss, right? So what happened is, over dinner in Pondicherry or Thiruvannamalai, I don't recall. So I asked this question to Eckhart, that I feel I'm talking on everyone's behalf, that when we lose loved ones, when we lose things we cherish, my understanding is because we derive our sense of self from them, we feel that loss. So if we did not derive our sense of self, then would we feel that loss? And he asked me, he said, can you proceed further? How would you investigate this further? I said that, what did one feel? Emptiness and a vacuum. Is it good or bad? I don't know. The fact is, it's a vacuum. So I said, Eckhart, the next question which I would like you to help me with to answer is that, as a young boy, the thought would come that what would happen if everyone I loved, everything I cherished, died at the same time. And we were having dinner, and he looked at me and he said, with a smile on his face, that is what enlightenment is, which is his most potent sentence, to die before you die and find there is no death. There is just emptiness, pure being, consciousness, awareness. Loss is a painful yet beautiful gift given by the source to rediscover itself and its original seat. It is a gradual taking away, a stripping away of all that is unnecessary for the divine light to shine. On the personal level, it's painful to lose a loved one, which is the journey of life. We lose our parents sooner or later. Children lose their parents. That is the way it is structured, is to learn from loss and experience loss. But in the seeker, in the aspirant, the investigation goes further as, who is losing? What is being lost? Who is still there experiencing the loss? Who am I prior to the loss, during the loss, and after the loss? It is the witness. And on a material level, as they say, if a jnani loses money, he feels it has gone out from one pocket and to another pocket, both of which are his. So to lose your judgments, loss. Lose your criticism, loss. Lose your hatred, lose your blame, lose your condemnation. And what is left is the vast peace of being, which can never be lost. That is what is yours. Everything else will come and go. At least taste that in this lifetime. Taste the ultimate, absolute absence of things, because that is already there. That is your true wealth. Your true wealth is truly nothing, which is yet everything, because that does not leave you. That brings about healing. When someone questioned Maharaj and said, you know, the way you're talking, it seems like you're already dead. What's the point of this? And his answer was, not only am I dead, I am double dead. I'm dead to my mind and I'm dead to my body. Which means what? He is abiding in his beingness as the light of consciousness, which is already there for all of us, not to be acquired. As that famous quotation, perfection is not when nothing more can be added, but when nothing more can be taken away. And then you discover the unshakable peace, like a rock, a large immovable rock of life. Nothing can be added to it, nothing can be taken away.